There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
We got Andre Gershel, Director of Operations, Regional Manager at Baker and Spice, who's going to bring some of his stories to the table.
It's great to be on the show. Thank you so much for having me, as usual.
Lovely to have you here. Thanks so much indeed for coming into our new home. It's not so new anymore. We've been here for a couple of months, but your first time down here, so welcome.
Thank you very much. It's actually quite beautiful down here. It's great to see all of the shows kind of working together in tandem at the same time. It's a lovely, lovely studio. Congratulations.
Yeah. So for all those that are tuning in for the first time or haven't been before, we have moved to a new home and we've all been put in the same barn, as it were. And I think, has anyone fallen out yet? I don't think we've had a big fallout with any of the other stations as yet. Has there been a big to-do as yet? I'm not here. I'm obviously in and out in no time at all. But you spend a little longer here every day.
I do. Just some friendly rivalry.
Okay.
But nothing...
Nothing gossip worthy.
Joe is a very talented zookeeper.
Nothing that I would divulge on air to you, Tom.
Very good. Okay, tell us off air. Right, we will be talking newspaper stories in just a few moments, a news review first hour. But I've got a talker that I want to throw out there for a number of you. And this is one that we'll hopefully be looking at in more detail just after 11 o'clock this morning. The question we're basically putting to you is, do manners still maketh man or woman? Is it okay to have bad manners? That certainly seems to be the suggestion from a research team at the University of Bristol, an esteemed seat of learning in the United Kingdom, who found that our traditional perception of manners are evolving with time, and therefore planes such as trains, theatres, even restaurants are seeing a new code of manner being introduced into those workplaces, into those arenas than would have been in years gone by. Obviously, a number of you will still be on the roads of the UAE this morning, and I don't need to tell you about manners on the roads of the UAE. I did the school run this morning and then drove into work, and the number of times I tutted and shook my head and muttered all sorts of nasties under my breath at people out there on the roads for cutting in or not acknowledging or just being rude. I mean, you see it on a daily basis. But this is something I want to talk about a little later on. And I wonder, it's perfect that we've got Andre with us as well, because Andre's been involved in the food and beverage industry throughout his career. You've been here for what, last 10?
Almost 10 years,
almost
that's
10
right.
Years
yeah.
Now that you and I have known each other. And have you seen a change? Has there been a shift when it comes to manners within food and beverage, within restaurants and bars?
You know, I think it's actually an interesting point. I think absolutely yes. I think it's interesting because you see it not just necessarily here in the UAE, but globally, where the art of taking a reservation and being hospitable is something that's changed a lot. A lot of people have now moved towards sort of a digital solution for that, where often to make a reservation, you actually don't even necessarily get to speak to an operator, but you would plug and play that right into the computer system. And some of these sort of older, more venerable restaurants have decided to make sure that this is a point of hospitality, yeah, as a point of manners, to greet someone when you arrive and give them a warm salutation on exit is one of the things that we trained at consistently at the Ivy and at most of the fine dining restaurants that I had the privilege to work at, making sure that everyone who came in was greeted appropriately on both entrance and exit was a big thing. And I'll sort of just close this idea with one thing, is that at Ritz-Carlton, there's an idea that I love, and it's sort of stuck with me along my career, but it's an idea that inside their internal training mechanisms, it says, ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen. And it's something I've always sort of liked, and I agree with it, and it's something I try and live by as much as possible in
my
career.
It's interesting you mentioned there about the booking systems as well, yeah. And I remember, you know, growing up in the boom time of the London food and beverage era at the end of the 90s, early 2000s. And, you know, you had to make, in order to make a reservation, you had to put your credit card down. You were held to it for 15 minutes or so. Things obviously are changing now, especially here with the availability you have and the fact that things are a lot more efficient. But it's so interesting when you make a reservation here and then you call back a restaurant to cancel that reservation, how appreciative they are of that, which sounds to me that a lot of people make reservations here, tables are booked up, and they forget to cancel them, or they just don't bother cancel them, which, to my mind, is rude.
All the time. All the time. we would love people to try and sort of stick to their books as much as possible. But I kind of like the informal environment of knowing that you can still get a walk-in table if you want one. There's something kind of nice in neighborhood about that that I also appreciate.
I want to ask people out there about manners. Do you think that manners are changing? Is there still a place in this world? And I don't for a minute want to come across as some old fuddy-duddy. I do it enough anyway. But with regards to the fact that, you know, we should bring back traditional old manners and everyone should be holding doors open for each other, et cetera, et cetera, and chivalry shouldn't be dead, et cetera. I get it. You know, I know that times are moving on. But is there such a thing as a modern code of manners? And if there is one of those modern manners that drives you mad, Joe McKibben, what's the one that drives you mad?
Mobile phones in cinemas.
In cinemas.
Oh,
becoming more and more acceptable. Used to be a complete no-no, and now people just turn a blind eye, don't they?
Oh, no, I don't turn a blind eye.
People don't, but they, but well, cinema
exactly.
Authorities do to it. You know, you don't. You're not sort of thrown out for using a phone in a cinema.
Far from it.
I've got Andre in studio with us. He is the director of operations, regional manager at Baker and Spice for the news review this morning. Great to have you. Baker and Spice grows. Says regional manager. How many have you got now?
So we'll have 12 by the end of the year,
which
is very exciting. Yeah, no, it's we've had a great expansion into Kuwait and Bahrain and Saudi coming up next year.
Amazing.
Yeah, we're really happy about
it. Look at that. And they're all going well, are they?
So far, so good. Touch all sorts of wood in the studio, of which I don't see any because it's brand new and beautiful. But we've been very privileged to sort of be the slow and sort of stoic growth rate that we would want to see. And as you know, organic and local sourcing is always difficult in this part of the world. But luckily, organic vegetables and agriculture has grown exponentially in the last 5-6 years. So we're very happy to take advantage of that and be able to bring it further across the region.
Amazing. Long may that success continue. I'm sure many of our listeners will have tasted the delights of Baker and Spice here in the region. And with that growth, you could do with something bigger than a drone to keep an eye on all 12 of those outlets around the region at the moment. But this is a new application of high-tech drones. Where?
It's actually in Japan. And one of the reasons that I chose this story is I think it sort of has a twofold meaning. Number one, it's obvious the obvious technological implications in a country like Japan, which has always been sort of a paragon of technology and an early adopter. But what I think is interesting is that rural farming, for the most part in Japan, is occupied by people who are generally considered senior citizens in Japanese culture, whereas younger generations obviously seek employment in the city. So you've seen sort of a downwards trend in the population of rural areas and an upward trend in sort of the urban areas. And this technology has allowed sort of people who are in older age categories and who are in the agricultural sector to be able to replace younger workers with this new technology. And I think it's really interesting. And I know that in the UAE, they are experimenting with that as well. Huge tracts of lands that are obviously very difficult to see all in one day, especially when you have large, vast crop areas, which are now being effectively completely automated by drones.
Amazing, isn't it? It's just showing you how that agriculture, one of the oldest industries known to mankind, is being automated at the moment. Technology being taken advantage of there. And I suppose it's even more pressing to a certain degree over in places like Japan, China to a certain extent, developing nations around the world elsewhere as well, where there is still this drive for young agricultural or rural populations to head for the cities, for the bright lights and the possibility of growth, which is having a detrimental effect on those that are left behind tending the crops.
Absolutely. And I think every country wants to sort of be self-sustainable, right? They want to be able to at least grow enough food and raise enough cattle to feed their own nation. And I think the technological implications of something like this are so fascinating to me, but it also talks about urbanization and the way in which you find cities getting more dense and rural areas getting less dense. But I think what's, to me, very interesting about this is that, so 673 drones have been registered, so now they have to each be registered in Japan just in the last year. So it's an example of an older generation adopting a newer technology, which is something, I think that retraining and repurposing just shows the agility that I think all of us could benefit from. And I think it's a great example of technology and agriculture kind of smashing together. And obviously, as a restaurateur, agriculture is a tremendously important thing for us to watch, particularly the way that we buy at Baker and Spice. So
especially
the more
here
farms,
as well,
exactly. I mean, arable land is always an issue in lots of countries. And even though Japan is very sort of service industry and technology industry heavy, from an agricultural perspective, they don't have that much land. Mm. They don't have that much arable land necessarily to raise crops and feed the nation. So I think this is particularly important now. And I think it's something that in many ways, many countries can take from.
It's a really interesting story as well, and it's one that sort of prompted me to think about the way that technology is being adopted here to means of agriculture and agribusiness here in the region. And it reminded me of that story recently that there is a Chinese company based here in the UAE now. I can't remember if it's Dubai or Abu Dhabi based, but somewhere in the UAE that are in a very advanced stages of trying to grow rice in the deserts of the UAE. They're using technology to sort of simulate paddy fields in very arid lands and use the nutrients that they can to grow rice. And they reckon that they are very close to producing their first crop of rice here as well, which could have a massive impact.
Massive, massive. I mean, look, the UAE is a big rice culture as much as it is a bread culture. And we always sort of, when we're sort of tackling new cuisines and trying out new dishes, we always ask the same question. Is this a rice culture or a bread culture? And I think the UAE is a very heavy bread culture. It's got great influences from many, many Southeast Asian countries and sort of a lot closer to home, India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka. And those are huge rice cultures. And I think it's very interesting for us to think about sustainability as decreasing imports and increasing exports as well. It's not just using less electricity. It's not just becoming carbon neutral. It's not just using solar energy in an interesting way. It's also growing our own food.
Pakistan's new government has a new leader as of the summer. And he's taking some rather bold moves. Tell me more, Andre.
So Imran Khan has decided to, means to promote austerity and fiscal responsibility, is going to be auctioning off 102 official governmental cars worth about 59 million dirhams. But my favorite part of this headline was also, in addition to those 102 cars, he will be auctioning off 8 government-owned buffaloes.
What?
Yeah, that's right. 8.
Is that a brand
government
of car?
No, I actually thought so was 2, and I looked it up as well. But it is, in fact, the actual livestock animal, which were kept by the former PM as part of his gastronomic requirements. And they were kept, apparently, at the actual PM's house itself.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, I want to know at what point someone went in and said, I'll take 2 Mercedes and a buffalo, please. That's like, I would like to know how that group deal was put together.
I suppose the wider part of this story is the fact that he's looking to bring a more transparent and frugal way of governing and doesn't see the need entirely for the lavish trappings of leadership that might well have gone before.
Absolutely. And to a great extent, I think that despite the fact that it is a tremendous amount of money that you'd be generating from such an auction, and obviously the 8 buffaloes, lest we forget, it is symbolic. And I think what's interesting about this is that there is a move towards austerity and fighting corruption and waste, which I think is interesting. I mean, he's not your typical politician. It seems to be the era of atypical politicians, by the way. But I think to a great extent, he's a cricketer. He is attempting to brand himself as a man of the people. And I like the idea that the nation's wealth should be shared with its rightful owners. And that's sort of been a rallying call for his initial term. And I can't, obviously, as a non-Pakistani national, comment on whether that has been a successful venture or not. But I think big moves like this do set the tone. And I think that's important in any economy.
My working knowledge of Pakistani politics is limited, goes without saying. That said, I have been a keen observer of it since my time here. And as a cricket fan as well, I've looked on, interestingly, with the career of Imran Khan over the recent years. There will always be critics, goes without saying. There are always two sides to the story, especially when it comes to, as there always should be with politics the world over. I suppose the critics there are talking about the new government, saying that it's just a little bit too modern. And these moves, whilst they are causing headlines and they're getting people over in the UAE and elsewhere to talk about it, probably more symbolic than significant because the country needs a lot more work done.
I mean, I think there's obviously, there's a small monetary value, but there's the PR value, which is here we are sitting in a radio station in Dubai discussing it. Yeah. And I think when you generate those discussions and when you make the idea of financial transparency at the forefront of dialogue, I think it's a tremendously powerful way to generate change. And even if it starts as something symbolic, often manifests itself into something significantly more concrete.
Just had a confirmation, in fact, ironically, just through in the last few minutes from our news desk there, where it has just been confirmed in the last few moments that Pakistan's new Prime Minister Imran Khan, who we've been talking about there, will be in the UAE tomorrow as part of his first official state visit here to the region since the former former Pakistani cricket captain was made president of the prime minister, I should say, of Pakistan over the summer. So details of that tour obviously being kept fairly close to their chest because of security concerns. But and what we do know is that he will visit Saudi Arabia and the UAE. We know that he'll be in the UAE from tomorrow, probably Saudi Arabia today at some point, at the invitation of the two countries' leadership, according to the foreign ministry announcing the details yesterday. It'll be the prime minister's first foreign visit since he took office in August of this year. Khan will be accompanied by the foreign minister, the finance minister, and his commerce advisor. Khan is expected to call on Saudi King Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud and hold a bilateral meeting with the Crown Prince on bilateral ties, according to the ministry statement. And then the delegation will also proceed to the UAE. They'll head to the Abu Dhabi first on Wednesday. That's tomorrow. Two sides will discuss bilateral interests, according to the statement. Still no confirmation whether he will be heading up here to Dubai. But Imran Khan in the UAE tomorrow, in the region today. And I'd love to hear from listeners out there since he took on the role of Prime Minister in August of this year. What does that mean for Pakistan? Are you a Pakistani national? Have you spent time in Pakistan? How do you welcome, the election of Imran Khan? Is it a turning point for the country? And if so, then please do share your thoughts. I suppose the other critics would say as well, if this, you know, in the interest of playing devil's advocate with this one, Andre, you know, he is an independently wealthy man. He's from a very wealthy and influential family in Pakistan. The critics, I suppose, could say that he doesn't need these cars himself because he's already a multimillionaire.
Yeah, look, you know, I always go back and forth about what type of politician the populace wants. And what's interesting about this idea is that, you know, as an American, we always seek to have a politician that we could throw a baseball with.
Yep.
Someone who has his sleeves rolled up, who kind of kisses babies and shakes hands. And it's funny because when we choose people for such a high position of responsibility, we want somebody relatable. But if we are going, God forbid, through a medical treatment or something severe, we don't want the nicest guy in the room. We want the smartest guy or girl in the room. And it's interesting the way that we choose those people. And so that he comes from a wealthy family, that he comes from a position of influence, that he's been in the spotlight for as long as he have, isn't that advantageous? Isn't that beneficial? Doesn't that give a certain context and sort of poise that maybe other lifelong or career bureaucrats wouldn't necessarily have? And as you said, there are always critics. I mean, just in the article itself, it says his austerity vows have been undercut by his nearly daily helicopter commutes from his home in the Islamabad hills. I mean, obviously taking a daily helicopter ride while preaching austerity is a tough one. And I imagine someone in his PR office should look into that.
Security.
But yeah, exactly. But at the same time, I think that it's generating the conversation. And the ends, to me, to a great extent, do justify the means.
The demand for nuts is going through the roof at the moment. Andre, tell me more.
Well, Spain's almond production has hit a record high at 61,000 tons this year for the 2018 and 19 season, and that is 15% up year on year. What I liked about this story particularly is that people are replacing traditional orchards where they were growing, let's say, wheat-intensive products or starch-intensive products with almond orchards, which grow beautifully against olives, which is obviously a big export for Spain as well. And I think a lot of that actually doesn't have to do necessarily with the consumption of the almond nut itself, but for the desire to use it in milks and alternative flours.
Of course, yeah, because you think of all the byproducts. I mean, I know we had a whinge about this last week when we were talking allergies and foodstuffs and food trends, etc. I have noticed nuts price, the price of especially almonds as well, go through the roof in recent years. Not through the roof. I mean, you still buy them, but they've become something of a, I'll treat myself. I'll get myself a big bag of dry roasted or salted almonds as opposed to them being part of your staple?
I actually made my own almond milk a couple of weeks ago, Tom. I did, and
it's super easy. It's great.
I know.
It's deceptively easy. I think that most people don't know how easy it is to do it themselves.
What do you do? Just milk them?
No. You soak them overnight, and then you do all sorts of things to them.
Don't give away your secrets.
But it's really milky, and it's really good for people who do have lactose intolerance. So, and if you make your own almond milk with the almonds that you buy in the supermarket, you have a far greater yield of milk.
That's interesting. I didn't actually know that part. We have to look into that. But to talk about the prices, because I do think that's an interesting point, is that it went from €3 for about 12 dirhams and 81 fils to about €9 per kilo in the last 4 years. That's a pretty tremendous spike.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen that from in the bakery as well.
Pine nuts went through it as well.
Pine nuts and now vanilla. Like two sprigs of vanilla is about 60 dirhams. Vanilla has exponentially increased in the last 3 years, tremendously. It's interesting. I don't know whether it's scarcity or whether it's this particular year's yield, but it is interesting to see some of these kind of what we used to consider kind of staples becoming luxury items.
And also, you can't substitute something like vanilla with a chemical substitute. Pure vanilla pods, you need to use that. So you have to spend the money and you have to take the hit for the cost.
100%. It's difficult to sort of explain, but it is interesting to see even commercial large-scale coffee chains have started to phase in milk alternatives now.
Yeah.
And specialty coffee drinks.
Yeah.
And I think we didn't see that necessarily at Starbucks or at Costa or some of the larger coffee chains before, but now it's kind of becoming commonplace.
Z's been in touch with us this morning as well, saying, "I'm Pakistani, born, raised here in Dubai." He, referring to Imran Khan, who we talked about in the first hour, is educated, he's philanthropic, and he's honest. It's a long way to prosperity, but our resilience has always been seen us through. Also talking about sustainability, that's what it is all about. Thank you very much indeed for that one. That's the latest from Z. Thanks also to Sai. Wajahat Ali has been in touch with us as a Pakistani based in Dubai long term. I'm very hopeful with the election of the new PM, Mr. Imran Khan, who visits the UAE tomorrow. It's not to say he was the best choice, but more like the best amongst a bad bunch. People needed change, and change is what we got. The general population is thus far happy. We will have to see if the PM delivers what he has promised. Thank you to all of our Pakistani friends this morning listening in, giving us their thoughts on the change of face at the top of the country's political spectrum as Imran Khan has come into power earlier on this year in August and is now heading to the UAE for his first official state visit. We talked manners at the beginning of the show with Andre Gershel, who's here in studio with us, regional manager of Baker and Spice here in Dubai and across the region. It's interesting that you've got a story that, touches on manners. We talk often about that phrase, manners maketh man. What about manners maketh women and Serena Williams?
Well, I think it's fair to say that everyone should be held accountable to the same manners, no matter what. And I think actually when it comes to athleticism and sportsmanship and the sense of competition, particularly in a sport like tennis, which has a lot of traditional rules to it. I think to a great extent, manners are extremely important. The way that you treat both victory and loss, to be humble about victory and to be stoic about loss and respectful of your opponent is something that I think is true to sportsmanship. This particular article about Serena Williams, who was docked one game and penalized by the umpire first for what appeared to be coaching from her coach who was in the stands, and then for what he deemed to be verbal abuse, actually really hit home for me personally. I used to play tennis very competitively in the States. I think that there is a double standard to a great extent in sports. And I think if you rewatch the videos of what happened, I think her reaction, actually, despite the fact that you might perceive it to be ill-mannered, was completely appropriate. When you have a career and when you're an athlete, and you dedicate hours and hours of your life to training and honing your sport. She's had a 23-year career. And when somebody impugns that, I think just as much as it's important to set boundaries with manners, it's also important to set boundaries with respect.
Okay. I'm going to take an alternative view on this one because it's one that I've discussed at length with friends, not just here on the show, but also on our sports show at the weekend as well, where we went to town on it last weekend. Mm. With those that agreed with your point, and to a certain extent, I do agree with your point. I think there is nothing wrong with any athlete, be they male, be they female, regardless of background, ethnicity or whatever, expressing themselves on their chosen arena of sport and challenging an umpire. I think umpires are there to be challenged. They should be questioned. They should be, you know, not every game is like rugby where it's yes, sir, no, sir. But even in rugby, rugby players go up and say, please, can you explain that to me, sir? Sir, please, sir, please, sir, can you explain it to me? Okay, it changes in other sports. I think when you take it, when you start personalizing it, and take it away from the rules of the game and start coming out with comments like, you'll never officiate on a court that I ever play on again, which is not her choice or decision playing on a professional tour. She doesn't get to choose who officiates her games because that's not what we pay the big bucks to go and watch at these games. We want to see a fair game, balanced game at the same time. When you start taking advantage of your position to try and leverage some influence on the court, I think that's wrong. I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, look, I disagree with you taking a point off me. I think she was probably misguided by calling him a thief and a liar. But there's nothing fundamentally wrong with that. That's what she thought. I think it's this whole thing of using your stage and your position to possibly threaten him.
You know, it's funny. I do respectfully disagree, but I'll explain why. I think there's two points to
this. No, Joe, we're not stopping here, right? Joe's like, can you just wrap this up, boys?
I will wrap it up as quickly as I can. But I think there's two things. Number one, there's the double standard issue, which is if someone else had committed the exact same act, what would have happened? So there's that, which we can put aside for a moment. But there's the main issue is that when you've been playing tennis that long, when you're an athlete in the spotlight for that long, you transcend simply the role of an athlete. You're a role model. And when you impugn somebody's reputation as a cheater, as a role model, if the same was said of a politician or a public figure of any other field, of course there would be a vehement response. This is, you know, she in 2016, she was the highest paid athlete, female athlete. In 2017, she topped Forbes. She made $29 million. So you're not just challenging a career as a tennis player. You're challenging a career as a role model whose responsibility is to set tone for tons of young women who are competing at very, very high levels of sport across the world and calling her a cheater. That's a very, very grave thing to say.
Let's just get to your final story because it reflects on one of the big stories of the week. And obviously yesterday, the big focus was on retirement. There's a lot more being done here. You mentioned there you're coming up to what, your 10-year anniversary of your time here in the UAE. You can take an international perspective. But there is, in that time and more recently, we've seen a lot more efforts to secure the future of expats here in the UAE. You picked up on the long-term residence visa here. Is that going to convince more and more people to stay, do you think?
Look, I certainly think so. And I know this has been sort of a hot topic, not just in the studio, but I know a lot of people have made comments about this just amongst my group of friends on Instagram.
Yeah.
And in social media, it's been something that's heavily reposted. And I think the idea of long-term residence is something that really needs to be addressed. There's so many friends that I have who have literally grown up in this country,
right,
who only know this country, whose parents are of other nationality. But for them, this is home. And I think it's interesting more for them than it is necessarily for people on the brink of retirement, because now they know that they can extend, they can invest in property, they can think about mortgages that are on 35 or even 45 years if they're in their late 40s versus before. I don't know if they would necessarily weigh that as advantageous.
But would that equation be added to if there was the prospect of, you know, dare we say, because it's one thing we hear quite often, you know, all good and well with this, but at the end of the day, you're citizens of other parts of the world, and therefore are you not therefore pining to get back to that part of the world, be it retirement or long term as well? Or do you think that's something that would be a bit of a game changer here as well?
I think it's a game changer here, and I think more often than not, people are not pining to get back to where they were.
Sure,
I think after 10 years, this is home for me. I don't have an out-by date. I don't call myself an expat. I'm a citizen.
Yep.
I hire people. I put money into the economy. I provide jobs. I purchase real estate and pay rent. I shop at supermarkets. I pay Salik. I mean, what is that if not a citizen?
Yep. No, it makes a very good point. And for those that, as you say, the third gen as well, those that have grown up here and don't really know any better. And it's interesting to look at the statistics there of people that have been third gen and, you know, they have their bit of a wobble and they go away and they might go to education in other parts of the world, but they often come back here to set up a business or to continue their careers.
Absolutely. And I think that is the mark of a successful nation, is its ability to sort of boomerang people back into it. And that you want to come back because you see that there's opportunities here that don't exist otherwhere.
I just want to finish up on all things manners, if I may. That's where we started and that's where we're going to end, because there's some good text messages that came in the first hour of the show that I just want to read out on reaction to some of the discussions we were having. Manners, good manners anyway. We are really just formalised kindness between, people. We could all do with a little more kindness, don't you think? And Diana sent in saying, bad manners, playing videos out loud from your phone in a restaurant, aka Facebook videos. Now, that was one that I had on my list of modern manners that need to be addressed. And I'm sure this is something that you see quite often. It just seems that our spaces, our private spaces, especially in a restaurant, are being invaded all the time at the moment by noise and interference, not just from the restaurant environment, but from our fellow diners.
Absolutely. And I think the same is true, not just necessarily in restaurants, but I agree heavily. Joe was talking about this earlier, but movie theaters, that is totally unacceptable to have your phone out during a movie theater. It drives me crazy.
We went to see The Invisibles 2 as a full family, and a gentleman sitting next to me, not only did he have his phone on his lap, he was having a conversation on the phone, a full proper conversation for about 20 minutes. And the thing is that I'm quite outspoken, but that really embarrasses my children. And they're going, don't say anything, Mummy, please don't say anything. Don't say anything, Mummy, don't do anything, don't say anything. And I'm like, well, I'm going to have to just sit like this and not look at him or get eye contact with him, because I'm going to have to politely ask him to get off the phone.
I would do so, and I'd lay into him with reckless abandon, Joe. That's what I
know. I couldn't embarrass my poor children.
I don't get it. I don't get why people play their videos so loud. I mean, often you don't know what the video is. You've been sent it through by somebody, and you're looking at it for the first time. It might be inappropriate, but at the same time, no one else needs to hear about that. But there seems to be this change now that your space around you, I don't know what the exact circumference is, but that space is your space, and you can do what you will in there.
Completely agree. I think personal space and volume and thinking about how to be considerate and ladies and gentlemen, living with ladies and gentlemen is an idea that I think I try and hold by.
I quite like that. I might take that one away for the remainder of the show. Really appreciate your thoughts and presence this morning. I know you're a busy man. If people need to get in touch with you, Mr. Andre, and all the team at Baker & Spice here in the region, what's the best way for them to do that?
Just literally walk into any one of the restaurants and shout my name at the top of your lungs.
You'll probably be there.
Yeah, literally. I don't have an office or a business card. It's one of the things I'm sort of proud of. And that means I really spend all my time in the restaurants themselves. And I think that's really the only way to run them. Restaurants are very, very hard to run. As many people know, it's a tough business. Yeah. Best way to do it is sort of from the front. And that means that 95% of the time I'm there. I'll be at the farmer's market starting winter, which is very exciting, which starts in November. And we are also opening a new restaurant, which is very exciting, in the Opera, which is more nightlife oriented with a larger kind of beverage selection than we normally do. And that's where I'll be.
Can't wait. We'll be looking forward to that. We'll speak more about that in the coming days and weeks. Andre, thanks so much indeed for your time.
Thank you so much, guys.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcast at DubaiEye1038.com.